I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week, our writer and culture critic Jimmy Israel, with us in Washington, D.C. Also here in Washington, civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar, with us from Boston, healthcare consultant and contributor to the National Review magazine, Neil Minkoff. Also with us, Michael Skolnick. He's editor-in-chief of GlobalGrind.com, with us from New York City. Take it, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas, welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Fellas,
hey, we're doing
on?
Good. Just, how you doing?
Just popping some tags because I only got $20 in my pocket.
That's what's up.
Wow. Whoa, there's espresso in the water today, and I'm feeling it. All right, let's get things started. You know, everyone's had their eyes on my hometown of Cleveland this week. If somehow you haven't heard, three missing women were found in the same house this week. They were allegedly kidnapped about 10 years ago, right, Michelle?
You know, I remember when this first happened, Jimmy, you were just ecstatic. I remember you talked about
was
that for a minute.
I mean, people that know me, for what it's worth, I mean, I love my hometown because my family is there, but I'm not a big fan of Cleveland. This is one of the very first times in a long time I feel like I can hold my head high. You know, I've never been so proud to be a Clevelander as now. You know,
put your Browns jersey on.
Right. But why? What is it? Stop.
I mean,
why is it? Because you just feel the way the community's rallied around these women, or what is it that
this
that
story
evokes
had the,
such
this
pride?
Story had the right ending. And mm-hmm. and well, when I first heard, I heard about it in the early morning hours Monday, and I shed a tear. I mean, I have a daughter, I have children, and if they had been gone for 10 years and reemerged, I don't know. I mean, it was amazing. It was amazing. Good time to be a Clevelander.
I hear you. Well, just to catch people up who may not be following all the facts of this case as closely as everyone else, as we know, the one of the women, Amanda Berry, escaped. She alerted the police. Authorities found there were two other women in the home. She immediately called attention to them. Unfortunately, I don't know if it's unfortunate or I don't know how to describe this, but that it does appear that the 6-year-old girl who was also rescued with Amanda Berry, the preliminary DNA tests that show that she is the daughter of the suspected kidnapper, Ariel Castro. Well, you know, this has so many threads to it, Jimmy. Why don't
right.
you just, you know, pick up the thread where you started it and just say what are your other thoughts about this?
You know,
this?
People wonder how this could have occurred. I used to live not far from where this occurred. And, you know, it's the kind of place where the pizza man doesn't deliver and the police, you had to call them 3 and 4 times, you know, to get any kind of response. So that's how this could have happened. And it's the kind of place where the neighbors don't necessarily trust each other. This couldn't have happened in Shaker Heights or Cleveland Heights, where this man's boarded up, kind of disheveled home would have attracted the attention of he would have gotten fined for it. You know, this could have only happened in the poorest of neighborhoods of Cleveland.
Interesting.
Michael Skolnick, you've been following this. Your reaction, brother.
I think you had it right. I think it was an incredible ending. I got to bring up my man Charles Ramsey, who heard the screams of Amanda Berry and ran to the door and kicked it down and helped her get out and gave to me one of the greatest interviews that we've seen in a long time. my man really came to the rescue, and not only came to the rescue, he was proud of what he had done. Even a 911 call when they asked him to give his name or his number if he wanted to, he said, "Of course I'm going to give my name, my number." He was so proud of what he had done, and I think that we need to applaud people like that who stand up and are not afraid to go to a house, as you said, had, you know, plastic bags over the windows and had never seen anyone come out of it. Charles came to the rescue and is a hero.
I took some issue with that early on because he certainly a good Samaritan, but I'm not sure if he did anything that any other black man wouldn't have done walking down the street necessarily. You know, I mean, I'm not taking anything away from him, but I don't know if I say he's exceptional. He doesn't deserve a cape on his back. I mean, I think his assessment that he was just a dude that did what he had to do at that time is the correct read. I think another dude walking down the street would have done the exact same thing. I believe that.
Okay.
Because I'm from Cleveland. I know my city.
Okay.
So can I jump in? I agree that a lot of people...
Neil,
done the same thing. I think that the reason we focused on him so much is he was so gregarious and so different, and it was a way of focusing on the case without focusing on the horror. That was my take on it, is it was the ultimate feel-good distraction. So if we focus on, is he a hero or isn't he a hero, or is he a great interviewer or is he kind of out there, we don't need to pay attention to what happened in this horrific basement in conditions we can't possibly imagine that shouldn't be happening next door to anybody. We'll just focus on the sideshow.
Dr. Neil, thanks for that. A-Train, you know,
just pointing out, remember, Neil is trained as a doctor, so you weren't being funny there.
Right.
I didn't mention that at the beginning, but he is trained as a doctor. It's an interesting perspective. Arslan, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, my take on that was that, you know, he kind of became this internet star, not just because he was gregarious and stuff, but also because this is a guy from the side of the tracks that most people that watching him on the news would cross the street to avoid. And this was an opportunity to kind of look and marvel at this cultural attaché from the dark side. And I resent that, frankly.
Okay.
No, I would resent that too. You know, for me, the most poignant part of Charles Ramsey's interview was when he said, quote, "When a little pretty white woman runs into the arms of a black man, you know something's wrong."
And he was just signifying. I mean, he wasn't dropping no social science. He was saying something
but
any barbershop
right,
in America.
But I think there is some social science to this. You know, obviously, you look at the historic case of Emmett Till, who was a 14-year-old teenager in Mississippi who was murdered in 1955 for allegedly flirting with a white woman. So, you know, there is this microcosm of, you know, what men of color in this country have had to deal with in terms of social interactions with people from, quote unquote, the other side of the tracks. And so, you know, for me, I think that really resonated, you know, in terms, you know, we know that there's no Good Samaritan laws in most states. You don't really have to do something if you know that a crime is being committed. He did something because, you know, he did it out of the goodness of his heart. But I thought that one quote really, really resonated with me.
Well, you know, to the point where it's now been auto-tuned. I mean, he as a character, and that quote itself has been auto-tuned. Do you want to hear it? Just so
I know you want to drop it.
Okay,
drop it.
Here it is.
I knew something was wrong when a little pretty white girl ran into a black man's arms. Dad gave away. My neighbor got big because we see this dude every day. We eat ribs with this dude, but we didn't have a clue that that girl was in that house.
Wow.
She said, "Please help me get out."
Oh, man.
I mean, wow. I got to give it up to the doc, though, in Boston, because, you know, this was so damn tragic. And the whole thing, as it unwinds, it gets even worse when you think about it. Unfathomable how a man could do this to a woman and for years. And just to have a laugh at the end of all this, just to, like, take a breath and say, man, this at least give me a good feeling that there is hope.
But
Let me ask you about this, though, because now, you know, Arslan, I don't know where you were just you put on your forecasting cap, but you know, you emailed earlier in the week to say, you know, no good deed is going to go unpunished, just wait. And then it emerges that one of the websites, The Smoking Gun, reports that he has a criminal past, that Mr. Ramsey was convicted of domestic abuse, that he stands accused and in fact was held accountable for hitting his wife, and there are other sort of issues there. So does that change anything for you? I just want to ask how you feel about that.
Yeah, you know, it was one of those things where I think what I actually emailed you was that, you know, no good deed in America by a man of color goes unpunished. Mm. And this was a perfect example of that. You know, this does not take away from the heroic acts that he did, you know, but it is going to be used by detractors to, you know, perpetuate stereotypes and things like that.
Yeah, the first thing I did when I saw his name is I ran it through the clerk of courts, and I was like, oh, man, he's in big trouble.
Why did you do that?
Because I'm a reporter. That's why I did it. Yeah, I mean, I did the diligence right off the bat. But, you know, to everybody's point about Mike, I appreciate your point about the levity and the dead giveaway. But why is the misery of poor and disenfranchised, often people of color, why is that fodder for auto-tune? You know, so Sweet Brown is running from her burning home, and Antoine Dawson trying to protect his sister who may or may not have been sexually assaulted. Now, this guy... You know, why is the misery of poor people, you know, entertainment fodder? He isn't a comedian. He's somebody in the midst of a very important emergency. And we're not laughing with him. We're laughing at him because we don't know him well enough to laugh with him. So I don't know.
One of the things I was responding to that he was saying wasn't, I was going a little different, where he was talking about the fact that he had eaten ribs with this guy. He knew this guy. He had no idea what was going on there. I was responding to the fact that he was putting it all out there, and he was saying, I can't understand how how this is happening around me. Like, I'm not a fan of the auto-tune. I'm not putting him down that way. I was saying that it was easier to focus on his reaction than it was to focus on the crime, because the crime is disgusting.
That's, well, but why? Well, I'm puzzled by why you insist that people are laughing at him. And let me just, for just the sake of accuracy, point out that there's another man, Angel Cordero, says he is the first person to help Amanda Berry. He was initially discovered by the Spanish language media. Now a lot of other people have interviewed him subsequently. It seems to me Amanda Berry can clear this all up at the appropriate time. I don't know just for what that's worth. Mm-hmm. But why are you so convinced that people are laughing at him?
Because he's not a comedian. He's somebody recounting something really ugly and scary that happened. And of course, he's signifying when he's doing it, and he's talking about he used to eat ribs with this dude. He's telling about the level of intimacy he had with his neighbor.
But maybe he's using humor in his own way to deal with the horror of the situation.
I think he's signifying about something very serious.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
And I appreciate that, but he's not a comedian.
Okay. I think we get it. You're listening to our weekly Barbershop Roundtable. We're joined by Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar, journalist Michael Skolnick, healthcare consultant Dr. Neil Minkoff. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's keep it moving. And by keep it moving, apparently, I guess it has exercise and stuff involved with it, as it involves Chris Christie, because I'm pulling for Duke, because the New Jersey governor acknowledged this week that he underwent weight loss surgery in February. Go get him, Christy. What do you say, Michelle?
Well, I don't know. What do you all say about this? One of the things I'm interested in, Arsalan, maybe I'll go to you first on this, and Neil, I certainly want to hear what you have to say as trained as a physician, is that, you know, with women, you know, we've kind of gotten to a point where, particularly people in politics, there's been a lot of discussion about whether you should even be talking about people's appearance and weight. And somehow with him, it's like open season on him. People are allowed to talk about this, you know, all the time. I mean, he's continually making appearance on late night talk show comedians' roster of almost like required jokes. You'd think it was in the Constitution that people were required to joke about him. But on the other hand, this is a serious issue. So I don't know. What do you think about it?
Oh, I think don't hate the player, hate the game. I totally support Chris Christie in this. You know, if it's going to help his overall health prospect. I mean, at the end of the day, it's about him. You know, it's about his health and what he feels is necessary for himself as a person and for his family. You know, like you said, Michelle, he has become fodder. I mean, he famously went on David Letterman, you know, eating a donut, you know, and had been the butt of jokes for a long time. And I'm sure now people are going to look at him a little more seriously.
Right.
But he also has been rather defensive when other people have raised it. For example, do you remember this? When a former White House physician said that his weight was a problem and that she was hoping that he would address it before he ran for her name is Dr. Connie Mariano, and she was on this program actually earlier too. Here's what he said about that.
She must be a genius. She should probably be the Surgeon General of the United States, I suspect, because she must be a genius. I think this is just another hack who wants 5 minutes on TV.
Ouch. So he obviously was not pleased.
Though.
So Neil, what do you think?
So I had the opportunity. I was actually standing right next to Chris Christie up here in November at an event, and I was shocked at how much bigger he seemed without a suit coat on, not on TV, right directly in front of me. As a medical professional, I think it's a great thing, as highlighting the problems with obesity and showing, especially as like kind of a tough guy, that it's okay as a tough guy to do something to take care of your weight and to take care of your family. I think that's a great message. I wonder if it's going to hurt his brand. I wonder if it's going to hurt his brand as the rambunctious, you know, heavy guy from New Jersey, kind of Soprano-esque that way, and whether it's going to, you know, because everybody kind of hints around that this is part of running for president, and it probably is, but I wonder if it's counterproductive.
You know, but if I could just jump in, I got an issue with Christie, man. I got a real big issue with him, because here he is on David Letterman the next day yelling at this doctor saying, you know, get out of here, and, you know, making fun of being fat, and then a week later he gets his tummy tucked, and this, you know, he acts like a tough guy. He wants to be the tough guy. He's not a tough guy. And when Michelle Obama, our first lady, has an incredible program, Let's Move, Republicans just, you know, diss her and say what she's doing, she shouldn't be doing that, and she's actually trying to promote healthy living and childhood obesity. If he wants to do something good for this country and good for himself, then promote not being fat, then promote being in shape, then promote not eating donuts and David Letterman. It's not a joke. Like, there are a lot of young, heavy-set kids who are watching him who are saying, oh, I can eat donuts too because the governor's eating donuts.
Mike, did you just call Chris Christie a studio gangster?
I'm saying, you know, it's like Mike came down from the Boogie Down Bronx with the intellectual brass knuckles on.
He just pulled a Udonis Haslam on him.
Gave him a whooping.
Okay, well, I have one more thing I wanted to run by you. And this is sorry, bums me out. But Lakers superstar Kobe Bryant is getting attention for moves on another court. His mom is trying to sell some of his memorabilia from earlier in his career, when his high school career. And she's been paid in advance of about $500,000 for an auction house. Kobe says he did not give his mother permission for this, and she's just retaliating against him because he would not buy her not just any house, but a bigger house than the one he's already bought her. And then she says he says she's mad because she claims that he's bought his in-laws a nicer house. And I just, ugh. But I do wonder about this. Arsalan, you're the attorney here. Does he have a case?
Well, first of all, this definitely gets the Redunculus Award of the Week.
But on whose part? For who?
On both of them. On the mama's part, mainly. It's like, come on, Kobe's mom. You know, we all have parents that have done things that we have not liked. You know, when I was graduating from law school, I handed my mom my diploma, and she looked at me and she said, "Are you going to surprise me now and go to medical school?"
Nice.
And it's like, you know, but she's still my mom, and I love her. And in this case, Kobe,
I think this is a little different. Kobe offered
to buy his parents a $250,000 house. They wanted like a $450,000 house. You know, the question remains who. Under whose ownership is the memorabilia currently? If it's sitting in a basement in the house of the parents, you know, a judge will have to decide, you know, is it still considered, quote-unquote, Kobe's property or not? But it's definitely the Redunculus Award of the week.
Mm-hmm. I'm sad about it. What about you, Jimmy?
I'm sad about it, too. I don't like to see, you know, families fight like this. Me and my mother had a very similar thing. She's trying to sell my typewriter, you know, to finance her next home. So far, there. I already
bought it.
Oh, well.
Clickety clack.
Right.
And what are you going to buy with it? A smart car?
Or lunch.
I think Kobe's mag is not in the playoffs. Knicks play tomorrow night. Let's focus on a real team.
Oh, wow. No. Oh, ouch. With that being said, Jimmy Israel's a writer and culture critic. He's also adjunct professor of film and social media at Cuyahoga Community College. He was with us in D.C. Also in D.C., Arsalan Iftikhar, civil rights attorney and founder of themuslimguide.com. Michael Skolnick is editor-in-chief of globalgrind.com. That's a news and entertainment site founded by Russell Simmons, with us from our NPR bureau in New York. Neil Minkoff is a former doctor. He's now a healthcare consultant. He's a contributor to The National Review, with us from NPR member station WGBH in Boston. Thank you all so much.
Peace.
Happy Mother's Day to the mamas.
Thank you.
Hey, yep, yep.
And remember, if you can't get enough Barbershop Buzz on the radio, look for our Barbershop podcast. That's in the iTunes store or at npr.org. That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more on Monday.